Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Brian Lynn will bring us this week's Science and Technology Report. Later, Steve Ember will present our American History series, The Making of a Nation. But first, space travel, survival trips, and flying through the air are all experiences people can have at a new kind of entertainment business in Los Angeles, California. It is called 2-Bit Circus. Many of the games at 2-Bit Circus are similar to traditional games of skill played at carnivals and amusement parks. They test simple skills like throwing objects to hit targets or knock over other objects. But they also involve new technology, including cameras and eyewear that surround users with computer-generated, three-dimensional pictures. These kinds of experiences are known as virtual reality. Kelly Bentall was a recent visitor who played a game in which she had to throw a plastic ball. Then, a computer-generated picture of the ball appeared on a screen in front of her. The picture followed the movements of the real ball and struck a picture of a computer-generated opponent. Bentall told VOA, "I think it takes a whole arcade game venue to the next level, and there's a couple of games I played tonight where I was out of breath." Another addition to the experience is the presence of a robot that serves alcoholic drinks. "I have not had a robot make my drink before," said John Duncan, another visitor. That was actually pretty cool. 2-Bit Circus presents the newest developments in game technology. Many of the experiences are created in a workspace connected to the entertainment center. Eric Gradman is the chief technology officer and helped create 2-Bit Circus. He also is a robot designer who created experimental designs for the United States military. Gradman said his group can build game designs and test them out in the center on the same day. He said his team is always experimenting with new forms of entertainment, and we have the most important ingredient of all, people to test this stuff on. Brent Bushnell helped Gradman create the center and is now its chief executive officer. He is an engineer, a businessman, and also the son of the creator of Atari, one of the earliest video game systems. Bushnell said his father loves 2-Bit Circus. "He's always got ideas, what things we should change, what we should do differently." The two co-creators of the Experimental Entertainment Center are also trained circus performers, or clowns. Gradman said, as a clown, he loved performing in front of thousands of people. "This place is a great way to combine those two loves, making stuff and performing," he said. 2-Bit Circus is about the size of a department store. That is a good thing for Gradman and Bushnell. Many department stores across the country have closed because people now buy many products online. That means there are large empty spaces available at a lower cost. Bushnell said, These empty stores provide enough space to test and improve new games. The two hope to design 2-bit circus in a way so that similar stores can be opened across the country.
A new study suggests climate conditions in the Sahara Desert have changed from wet to dry about every 20,000 years. The study was carried out by scientists at America's Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or MIT. Findings were published in the journal Science Advances. The research was partly funded by the National Science Foundation. The Sahara Desert is known as one of the hottest, driest, and most desolate areas in the world. It covers about 9.3 million square kilometers across North Africa. But previous evidence has suggested the Sahara did not always experience such extreme heat and dry conditions. The evidence included material collected from fossils and rock paintings from the area. The evidence showed that at times the Sahara changed to a very wet climate. This permitted plants and animals to develop and grow, and led to the creation of human settlements. Now, MIT researchers have discovered more evidence of this changing climate. The scientists examined dust gathered from the coast of West Africa over the past 240,000 years. The research showed that during that period, the Sahara's climate kept changing between wet and dry about every 20,000 years. David McGee is an associate professor in MIT's Department of Earth, Atmospheric, and Planetary Sciences. He helped lead the study. McGee told MIT News, the new evidence supports the idea that the area's climate repeatedly kept changing over the years. Our results suggest the story of North African climate is dominantly this 20,000-year beat going back and forth between a green and dry Sahara, he said. McGee and other researchers reported these back-and-forth climate changes were mainly driven by changes in the Earth's axis as the planet orbits the sun. This process affects the amount of sunlight between seasons. The research suggests that every 20,000 years, the Earth receives more intense summer sunlight. When the Earth's axis changes again, the amount of sunlight is reduced. This season change happened continuously every 20,000 years, the study found. The other part of the season produced monsoon conditions, resulting in a wetter, greener, plant-rich environment. When the rainy activity weakens, the climate becomes hot and dry, like the Sahara remains today. The scientists based their research on dust samples collected from ocean sediment. They said hundreds of millions of tons of Saharan dust had built up over hundreds of thousands of years in the Atlantic Ocean bottom off the coast of West Africa. An examination of the dust buildup permitted the researchers to learn about the Sahara Desert's climate history. The samples contained layers of ancient sediment built up over millions of years. Each layer could contain traces of Saharan dust as well as the remains of life forms, MIT News reported. This information was used to estimate over what time period the dust had built up. This led to the overall finding that the Saharan changes from wet to dry climates happened every 20,000 years. Researcher David McGee told MIT News that today we only see the Sahara Desert as an extremely desolate and inhospitable place. The new study suggests that the area's climate has shifted between grasslands and a much wetter environment and back to dry climates, even over the last 250,000 years. McGee says he thinks the latest research can be valuable in studying the Sahara's history as it relates to human settlement. I'm Brian Lynn.
In the early 1990s, scientist Sue Hendrickson discovered the world's largest Tyrannosaurus rex dinosaur skeleton. It was found in rock formations in the American state of South Dakota. The skeleton is known as Sue, in honor of Hendrickson. Visitors to the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago have been able to see Sue since 2000. However, for most of 2018, Sue was nowhere to be seen. Instead, experts spent 10 months working on and adding to the world-famous skeleton. Jaap Hoogstraten is the Field Museum's Director of Exhibitions. He says museum workers have learned new things about the skeleton's shape since 2000.
Since 2000, we've made discoveries about the pose. We've added the gastralia, which are the belly ribs, which changes the outline of Sue quite a bit.
The ribs themselves are not a new discovery. They have existed since the fossil was recovered. But scientists only recently understood how they fit onto the skeleton. That understanding greatly changes what is known about the Tyrannosaurus rex. Hillary Hansen is the Field Museum project manager.
I didn't really realize that Sue weighed 9 tons in real life. Really adding this gastralia, these belly ribs, really changes the profile for Sue, and you can get a sense of just how formidable and imposing it must have been to share an environment with this animal.
Hansen adds that Sue's newly opened exhibit changes our understanding of the animal itself. It also helps show visitors Sue's natural environment and place in history. The Field Museum usually welcomes over 1 million visitors a year. But Hansen expects that number to increase because of the new Sue exhibit. She said the museum is expecting up to 10,000 visitors each day in the first weeks of 2019.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. Last time on our program, we talked about the election of 1840. William Henry Harrison easily defeated Martin Van Buren and became the 9th president of the United States. By that time, another political force was growing in the country. It did not come from Van Buren's Democratic Party, nor did it come from Harrison's Whig Party. It grew out of slavery. The dispute over slavery appeared to have been resolved for a time. A political compromise in 1820 kept a balance between slave and non-slave states. The compromise also barred slavery in the northern part of the Louisiana Purchase. But during the 1830s, the issue of slavery rose to the surface again. A major reason why the dispute came to life again was cotton. Cotton plants grew in many fields across the southern states. Black slaves planted, picked, and took care of the cotton crops. They also had other duties on southern farms. Northern ships then carried southern cotton to the markets of Europe. Manufactured goods needed in the South came from the North. The situation deeply troubled the political leaders of the South. They worried that cotton made their states economically dependent on the industrial North. What made things worse was the fact that most federal spending on public works projects went to the northern states. Then there was the old dispute over import taxes. Taxes on foreign goods mostly helped the manufacturers of the North. The taxes were to be lowered in 1842, but that was still years away. No one could be sure what would happen then. Such were the general political and economic conditions in the United States when the abolitionist movement began to make itself known. Abolitionism was an effort to end slavery and the slave trade. At first, religious groups organized the abolitionist movement. Then, in the 1830s, anti-slavery societies began operating in New York and New England. Many abolitionist groups published newspapers, pamphlets, and booklets. They flooded the country with anti-slavery petitions. Abolitionists believed slavery was evil and that there could be no compromise with evil. They did not like the idea that slaves should become free slowly over time, and they did not think slaveholders should be paid to free their slaves. They just wanted all slavery to disappear immediately.
They were regarded as this wild-eyed, fanatic group on the far left inside of the anti-slavery movement. People who were willing to do anything, radicals, they would upend society. This was the view that the people had of them.
Howard Jones is an historian. For many years, he taught at the University of Alabama. He says the abolitionists did not have much popular support. In the South, slavery was not a question of right or wrong. It was a question of survival. Some Southerners believed that without slavery, their whole economic system would lie in ruins. In the North, the abolitionists did not yet have major support. Some feared the abolitionist movement would weaken the rule of law. Even if they did not like slavery, these people believed the Constitution permitted it. As a result of the public feeling at the time, abolitionists struggled to communicate their message. Some states even sought to stop the flow of anti-slavery literature across their borders. In 1836, the House of Representatives declared it would not listen to any anti-slavery petitions. This decision became known as the gag rule. The Senate did not pass such a rule, but it did develop a complex, indirect method to delay action on anti-slavery petitions. Then something strange happened. Historian Howard Jones says some abolitionists believed the event was God's way of helping their cause. In August of 1839, a slave ship appeared in waters off the coast of New York. The ship was carrying two white Spanish-speaking men and about 50 men, women, and children from Africa. The captain was missing. American sailors stopped the ship and brought everyone to the mainland. No one knew what to do with the Africans. Were they criminals? Slaves? If so, who did they belong to? The Africans did not speak English or Spanish, so they could not explain themselves. The government jailed the Africans in New Haven, Connecticut, while officials tried to decide what to do. The slave ship was called the Amistad, and the case became known as the Amistad case. One of the leaders of the abolitionist movement, a man named Lewis Tappan, was very wealthy. Howard Jones says that Mr. Tappan sought to use the Amistad case to gain support for ending slavery.
What Tappan wanted to do was to use his almost unlimited financial resources to take these people to court, the Amistad captives, 53 of them, and show that they were human beings, that they had a right to be free.
The abolitionists found a free black man who spoke both English and Mende, the language of a few of the Africans. This translator helped explain what happened. The Mende said they had been kidnapped from their homes in West Africa. They were forced to march to the coast. There, white slave traders bought them. At that time, the United States, Spain, and many other countries had signed treaties to ban the international slave trade. The United States had also made buying slaves from Africa illegal, but the government did not enforce the law. A Portuguese ship brought the Mende and several hundred other captured Africans to Cuba. Many died of sickness, starvation, or beatings on the long trip across the Atlantic Ocean, which was called the Middle Passage. Those who survived were brought to a market in Havana. Cuba was a Spanish colony at the time. Spanish law said slavery was legal on the island, but the slave trade was not. To get around the law, many traders acted as if captured Africans had been living in Cuba as slaves for a long time. For instance, one of the young Mende men was named Sengbe Pie. Two Cuban middlemen bought him and about 50 other men, women, and children for farms on the other side of the island. The middlemen wrote his name in their records as Joseph Sinque. They gave the other Africans Spanish names too, so it would seem like the Africans had been born in Cuba. Then they loaded the group onto a ship called the Amistad, a name that means friendship in Spanish, and chained them below deck. Historian Howard Jones says the Amistad was like a taxi.
It would transport slaves wherever you wanted them to be taken. Now, they weren't really slaves. They had never been enslaved, but they were called that at this point. That's a critical issue in this whole thing.
A few nights later, Sengbe Pie and some of the other Africans broke free. They found weapons and waited until sunrise. The next morning, Pie and his shipmates killed the captain of the Amistad and the cook. Two crew members escaped. The Cuban middlemen were the only white people who remained. The Africans said they would let the Cubans live, but only if they brought the ship back to Africa. The middlemen agreed. During the day, they sailed the Amistad southeast, but at night, they turned the ship northwest toward the United States, hoping to arrive one day in a friendly southern port. Nearly 2 months later, the food and water on the Amistad were gone. Several of the Africans took a small boat to land to get more supplies. The captain of a government ship saw them. He brought the Africans and the Amistad into port in the northern state of Connecticut. The Cuban middlemen told their side of the story. They said the Africans were slaves who had revolted and claimed the ship's passengers as property. The Spanish government agreed with the middlemen. It demanded that the ship and the Africans be returned to Cuba. Spain's queen said that Spanish law would decide what happened next. Martin Van Buren, who was president at the time, liked the Spanish idea. He did not want to cause problems with Southern voters and politicians. He wanted to avoid the issue. But it was too late. The captain of the government ship said the Amistad and the Africans on it belonged to him. He said he had found them and he had a right to sell the Africans as slaves. The captain gave the middlemen permission to go, and he gave the Africans to the U.S. government to decide the case. The charges against the Amistad Africans were serious. They were accused of being murderers and pirates. If they were found guilty, they could be enslaved for the rest of their lives or put to death. But the abolitionists claimed the Amistad Africans were something entirely different. They said the Africans were captives who had been kidnapped illegally. The Africans should not be punished, the abolitionists said, but returned to Africa. Historian Howard Jones says the abolitionists looked forward to presenting the case in court. They also hoped Sengbe Pie and the others could help with their communication problems. They wanted the Amistad Africans to tell Americans what life in Africa was like.
But more important than that, what it was like on the dread African slave trade, that middle passage, those thousands of miles of crossing the ocean to the New World, and then, by extension, throw a dark light on what slavery was like itself.
I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.